So this is a talk which is originally designed as a colloquium for a departmental audience, and I see this is an audience of very high-powered theorists, so I hope you forgive me if at various times I'm too elementary, mainly focused on the condensed matter part. I think I only see a few condensed matter friends in the audience. So the title is meant to be provocative. Quantum criticality, or the study of quantum critical points, is something I've been working on for longer than I care to remember, thinking about various properties of condensed matter systems. We are going to face them, and I'll introduce some of these systems to you today. And in the last couple of years, via the ADS-CFT connection, we found that we can say a few more things about quantum critical points of interest in condensed matter. So to me, this was a complete revelation that thinking about black holes in the ADS spaces that I'll discuss very briefly can teach you something about problems that are seemingly mundane issues having to do with transport properties and critical points. So that's the main purpose of my talk today, to introduce this subject. So I've had a number of collaborators. I'm really a novice in string theory. And the work started through discussions with John Sohn from the University of Washington. And then grew to many other people involved on the left side. And the work I'll talk about really was a wonderful collaboration where on the East Coast there was Marcus Mueller, who I believe visited here a few weeks ago, postdoc at Harvard, and I were doing a very traditional condensed matter calculation inspired by what we had learned from string theory. And on the West Coast there was Sean Hartnall and Powell and Chris were doing a calculation in string theory. And at the end of the calculation, there was a perfect agreement. So these astonishingly different calculations in detail of a very non-trivial sort of set of correlation functions, they agreed perfectly. And I'll certainly give you a more condensed matter perspective on it, but it's really been quite exciting to see this cross-fertilization from very different fields. All right, so let me just begin by introducing terms. Again, probably superfluous in this audience. So a key ingredient in understanding quantum critical points is the idea of entanglement, which is the generalization of the superposition principle of quantum mechanics when applied to more than one degree of freedom. So, for example, the simplest entangled state would be the two electrons in a hydrogen molecule, which could form this valence bond state. And now, even though I may separate the electrons spatially, there's a non-local type of entanglement between their quantum states. If one is up, then the other is certainly down, and vice versa. And so the idea is really, how do you generalize this kind of EPR type of entanglement? How do you talk about this when you go to many degrees of freedom, not just two, but millions. One key place where you have the ideas of entanglement playing some role is near a quantum phase condition. And very loosely speaking, you can talk about define a quantum phase condition as a point where the many-body wave function has a change in the nature of its entanglement. So those are easy words to say, very loosely stated. The whole purpose of the theory is to make that more precise, to figure out exactly when you have a quantum critical point and how do you characterize the change in the nature of the wave function, and in particular, how do you characterize the wave function right at the critical point, where often you have the most non-trivial types of entanglement, in which traditional measures of entanglement really are not precise enough to talk about what's going on. So that's what quantum criticality is in terms of buzzwords. It's talking about these complex quantum states which are found at the boundary between two quantum phases, which you can understand reasonably well from more simple limiting pictures that I'll discuss very shortly. All right, so here's the definition of quantum criticality very loosely. Here's what I'm going to do. I'll begin by talking about some experiments in quantum condensed matter systems, in this case, experiments on a system that's extremely well understood. And then we'll give you a picture of the kind of problem to be interested in. Very naturally, so this will be one of the simplest classes of quantum critical points that have been experimentally studied, and which end up being described by relativistic field theories, and are, you know, extremely well understood. Then I'll take a detour for this audience. This will probably be very briefer than it would be otherwise. A totally different subject, which is the properties of black hole thermodynamics and the properties of waves in the presence of black holes. And what the ADS-CFT connection has shown is that there's a deep correlation between these two systems, as I'll try to illustrate. Then the main part of my talk, or the technical part of computation here in this collaboration, was thinking about a rather complicated type of response function of certain superconductors, which has been measured a lot recently in the cube rates, something called the Nernst effect. And it turned out that the Nernst effect is related to the properties of electromagnetic waves near dionic black holes. So there's this correspondence we discovered, and the Nernst response of these dionic black holes the response of the dionic black holes is related to detailed hydrodynamic characterization of the Nernst effect. So there's a number of experimental tests we can apply to this, although the correspondence of the experiments has to be taken with a grain of salt, because it's not yet clear, you know, how close we are in the qubit superconductors to a quantum critical point. More recently, and I'll mention this towards the end of my talk, and I guess you've heard about this, I understand, from a colloquium last week, graphene is another relativistic system that's been discovered in condensed matter. And we were very quickly able to extend a lot of these things we learned from the studies of black holes to graphene and predict a whole host of new effects, which we hope will be seen in the future. In this case, you know, we're pretty confident that we can predict all the numbers rather accurately. So it'll be a real test of these ideas. Okay, so let me just begin then with a well-understood system of quantum spins, which has been studied in experiments. All right, so this is the qubit superconductor will play a big role in my talk. So what they descend from crystals which have a structure of this type. It's looking rather complicated already. But mainly, you just focus on the copper atoms. These are these black circles here. And the coppers form a square net. And these square lattices are well separated from each other. And as you change the composition of the atoms away from the square lattice, you end up changing the effective numbers of electrons on the square lattice. And as you change the number of electrons, you go from an antiferromagnetic insulator that I'll briefly discuss in the next transparency to superconductor. And I'll say more about this phase diagram as I go along. Now let me just focus on this undoped system, or the antiferromagnetic insulator. So in that case, it turns out that the configuration of the square lattice consists of just a single electron, single unpaired electron on each copper atom. And you can basically ignore all the other electrons because the orbital are either empty or doubly occupied. And well, and you know, with an energy gap that's much larger than room temperature. So you can take, in this limit, just take this very complicated problem and reduce it to this very simple problem of spins or qubits sitting on the sides of a square lattice. And if you take this particular system and measure ask what are these spins doing, well, they in fact order in this checkerboard pattern with half the spins up and the other half down, arranged so that each up only has down neighbors and vice versa. And so this is a quantum state that's been measured experimentally, and really just the fact that I can describe it in such classical terms means there's essentially no entanglement or any, there is a small amount of entanglement between the spins, but it's smoothly connected to a state where they're just essentially decoupled and described by a classical state of this type. Okay, so what are the excitations of this state? So if you really were to create such a state, and these have also been measured experimentally, the excitation would consist of slow deformations of this order. These are Goldstone modes, if you wish, where the spins just wave around a bit, and they can move clockwise or anticlockwise out of this ordered state. And those are the two spin waves. So the important point is that they're gapless excitations that disperse linearly just like phonons, and there's two of them, two possible polarizations. Those are the main things to keep in mind about this state. Okay, what I want to do now is, as a theorist, I want to destroy this very perfect looking state in some way. I want to get a new quantum state. And one way to do it, which I'll illustrate today, is you imagine that you take some of the bonds and make them weaker. So I should have said earlier that these red bonds, the reason you get the checkerboard pattern is the red bonds represent an exchange interaction between the spins, which likes to have them anti-parallel. So what I'm going to do is weaken some of them so that you have the strong bonds, which are the reds, and the weak bonds, which are the green. And I ask what happens as a function of the ratio of the strong to the weak bonds up to the ground state. Well, you can see quite easily that eventually you're going to get a totally different type of ground state. So one way to see that is take the limit where the green bonds completely disappear. So when the green bonds have completely disappeared, you're basically left with a bunch of hydrogen molecules, very much like the pictures I showed you at the beginning of the talk. And what the spins will do in each such molecule is form this entangled state. The up will entangle with the down minus the opposite combination. So this is a rotationally invariant state. The spins are formed form a singlet. And you just take the product of these singlets, and this is a unique it's a non-degenerate state, which is clearly the ground state when the red bonds are much weaker, much stronger than the red-green bonds. In fact, you can show that it's stable because perturbation theory is well defined. There's no infrared problems. So you can even crank up the green bonds to some appreciable number, and you won't change any crucial features of the ground state. So what are some of the properties of this ground state? Well, you can see quite easily there's something now very different. There's some local type of entanglement, but more importantly, the excitations are very, very different. So how are you going to create an excitation? Well, the way you're going to create an excitation is by breaking a bond and having the spins then being parallel to each other. So that's an excitation of the decoupled system of hydrogen molecules. But in this lattice, there's also coupling. The green couplings are non-zero. And the effect of this green coupling of this broken bond will be basically to have it travel through the system. So what you have then is a particle moving through the system, which is carries spin one, and which requires a finite energy to create. So these are to be distinguished from the spin wave we saw earlier, where you require no energy at long wavelengths. And there were two polarizations. Here you have three polarizations, and there's an energy gap. So it's clearly qualitatively distinct from the Néel state. So because of this, now I can immediately conclude that as I vary this parameter lambda, which is just the ratio of the green to the red bonds, then for small lambda, when all the bonds are equal, I have this ordered antiferromagnet with no entanglement. And for large lambda, I have these product over entangled pairs. And there has to be a very sharp point. One, at least one. In fact, we know for this model exactly one critical point, lambda c, position is known very precisely, where there's a phase transition between this state and this state, where you go on this side at very low energies, you have two spin wave excitations which are gapless. You have a broken symmetry, and you have Goldstone modes. On the other side, you have no broken symmetry. You have a gap and three and a triplet of excitations. And that qualitative distinction appears precisely at one point. So there is then something non-trivial going on at this critical point in between. So there is some highly non-trivial wave state here whose wave function I won't even attempt to write down. It's something extremely complicated, which we only have a limited understanding of. And of course, when you're not exactly that point, but nearby, then over some distance scale, you still have to worry about this critical state. But eventually, at long enough scale, the state looks like the pictures have shown. All right. Now let me just show you that this is just there are actually experiments that have measured some of this, some of them quite recently. So here's a compound. This is not the cuprates. This is thallium copper chloride. And thallium copper chloride consists of basically pairs of these sets of copper dimers. So again, it's a very complicated system. Ignore everything except the copper sites. And here's the network, the skeleton network of the copper sites. And what you see then is that there's a pair of copper sites labeled by the dark bond that are closer to each other than any other. And this pair replicates. So it's really qualitatively very similar to the structure of this lattice, except it's not so beautiful and square. It's some rather more complicated network in three dimensions, but it's just a collection of dimers. Now, what you can do in this system is you can apply pressure to it. And under pressure, you will find that you can change the ratio of the dashed lines to the dark lines. So in effect, this axis becomes the pressure axis in thallium copper chloride. And experimentally, you can tune your quantum state from one end to the other. Really, that's, you know, in condensed matter, that's really the biggest problem in studying quantum critical point. It's very rare that you have a clean parameter that you can tune to really explore the full phase diagram. So for example, in ambient pressure, if you do neutron scattering, this is the kind of spectrum you see as a function of momentum and energies. So this is the momentum transfer of a neutron that you send in a neutron that scatters off these spins, and it goes out with a different energy and momentum. And both from the momentum transfer and energy transfer, you can read off the dispersion relation of the excitations in the spin system. And this dispersion here, it's rather more complicated, is precisely this triplon particle I was talking about. Here's, you know, this sharp peak in the scattering cross section as a function of energy transfer at a given momentum is what tells you that there's a sharp long-lived particle. You know, this is the bottom of the band, and there's the finite energy gap. Now, what you can do is apply pressure. What happens as you apply pressure, this is a very recent and beautiful experiment showing you this quantum phase transition. What happens as you apply pressure is that this gap closes at a critical point. It eventually goes to zero, and then beyond that point, you get the other ordered state that I showed you on this side. So how does that show up in this? This is the actual data. It takes some interpretation. I won't go into all the details here. Let's just focus on the summary of the data here as a function of pressure. So here, this blue line, ignore the black line. This blue line is the energy of the lowest energy triplon you can create in this state here. So that's this energy gap. And what you see is that as you apply pressure, this cap closes down here. And then on the other side, you get a zero energy mode. There's your Goldstone mode. But you also get another high energy excitation which goes up. This is really the analog of the Higgs particle. It's the longitudinal excitation which must meet at the critical point with the Goldstone mode to give you the triple state on the other side. So this whole structure of excitations is what has been theoretically predicted, and it's beautifully observed in this very recent experiment. And the quantum critical point is right here. In this case, since it's in three dimensions, the critical point is pretty well understood, and you know, you can really in detail understand what's going on.
Or is there some error?
I think the error bar at the site,
So I see that yellow point. I mean, is that really?
No, that's just a theorist point. That's not a data point. What you do see on this side of the spin wave excitation, which are practically zero, there's one complication here which I haven't mentioned, is the spin orbit coupling complaint. Spin orbit coupling, you know, actually breaks the spin rotation invariance a little bit. And that's what's responsible for this coupling and this gap here. So if you really get near the critical point, you do have to worry about the spin orbit effects. But qualitatively, the general picture that a simple picture I'm describing works beautifully. This is a simple enough system, but it's taken a lot of work to get to this stage, to see this kind of quantum phase transition such clarity. All right. Now for the for the qubit superconductors that I began the discussion with, you could say, well, this is all well and good for titanium copper chloride, but the qubit superconductors look nothing like that. And that's true. The most important way the qubit superconductors differ is that they do have perfect square lattice symmetry. Now, why should that be important? Well, this state that I wrote down here, this state, was simple only because I broke the square lattice symmetry. And it was simple because each spin had a unique partner it wanted to entangle with, the one on the right, or vice versa. And there was no choice to be made. And that gave you a very simple product of entangled pairs. Well, when you go to something with full square lattice symmetry as in the qubits, that's clearly not the case. So any other quantum state you're going to get is going to be far more complicated. Of course, there's the nail state, this ordered state, but what about more entangled states? And this has been a topic that we've been worrying about quite a lot. So one particular model that's been theoretically studied by Sandvik and also by Roger Melko here, actually did some earlier work in a related model, and more since then, is a model where you take this antiferromagnet and add a ring exchange term, some complicated term that perturbs the ordered state. In this case, there's still a lot of debate as to what exactly is the nature of the quantum critical point. But what you get on the other side is a new quantum state, which looks very much like this product of entangled pairs. But the entanglement again happens within pairs, but the system spontaneously decides how to pair up the spins. So these dimers or the singlets of spins crystallize in this regular arrangement, and there's other equivalent arrangements that could form, and any such crystallization breaks the square lattice symmetry. So there's a lot of subtleties which I won't go into on exactly how you go from this kind of nail state to this state that breaks square lattice symmetry spontaneously, and what happens near the critical point. Anyway, so that's, you know, just a gentle introduction to one well understood quantum critical point, and one not so well understood, but under great study even today. But a natural question arises at this point, you know, why do you care so much about this very special point in these complicated many-body systems? Well, one important reason is the following. So suppose I take this simple example, this example I just mentioned, between the nails state of ordered spins and this solid of valence bonds. And there's some critical value, say, where you go from one state to the other. The question I want to ask is, if I take an experimental system like this and measure its properties, well, I'm always going to have a finite temperature. And the key point is that this very special critical point between these two states will be the most important point in understanding what's going on over this exaggerated region, this yellow region. It doesn't extend out to infinity. In some systems, maybe, you know, down to some low temperature here. But there's nevertheless a finite region of parameter space where you, in fact, don't care about either of these well-understood states at either end, but are dominated by the properties of this very non-trivial entangled state right here. So why is this the case? Well, I'll just give you a rough argument. One way to think about this is, let's just start, for example, on this side. So here on this side, we have this product of dimers as our ground state. Let me raise the temperature a bit. What's going to happen? Well, I'm going to create these triplons, which are going to move through the lattice. And at low temperatures, I just have a dilute concentration of them. And I can just treat them then as well-separated excitations. But as I keep raising the temperature, I'll get more and more of these. And in particular, when the temperatures are of order the energy gap, and that's precisely this line here, I get so many of them that really it's not a good approximation to think of them as excitations of this ordered state. A much better way to think about what's happening here, say, is to imagine that I was right at the critical point and I raised my temperature. Well, then I have some very non-trivial excitation of the critical point, which I do not understand, and I have some thermal bath of these excitations, where temperature now is a fairly large energy scale. It's larger than the energy gap at this point. So if I now tune my parameter a little bit away from this thermally excited state, moving that direction, well, I moved only a small distance, And the energy scale associated with that motion is still smaller than temperature. And therefore, it really has a very limited effect. So that over this entire yellow region then, you in fact need to know the properties of the critical point here and what happens to it at finite temperature. And that's broadly the subject of quantum criticality that many of us have been thinking about for many years, trying to describe the dynamics of systems and what you would see in experiments in this region. So in this case, and many other cases, it turns out that this critical point is described by a mathematical object called a quantum field, conformal field theory. It's a highly non-trivial interacting field theory. And therefore, in this entire yellow region then, what you really need to know are properties of conformal field theories at finite temperature. And this, you know, not stated in this so explicitly, but this is the subject that I've been thinking about for, you know, over 15 years or so. How do you describe various transfer properties or various observable properties of conformal field theories in this intermediate temperature region? Okay. So that's then the introduction to why I'm interested in conformal field theories and where they might appear in condensed matter. And in the last few years, as I'm sure many of you know, related questions have arisen in a completely different field of physics where there's been some remarkable advances. And these come from an entirely different starting point. And this is in thinking about the quantum theory of black holes. Okay, so this here I'm skating on thin ice, so to speak, because I didn't know most of this two or three years ago. The last time I saw any of this was in graduate school, which was a long time ago. Okay, so just a quick review, very quickly. So what's a black hole? Well, you all know. And a black hole has a horizon, which is related to its mass, and black hole thermodynamics. So the starting point of everything really were these astonishing observations by Bekenstein and Hawking, that any black hole has very naturally associated with it the concept of temperature and the concept of entropy. In particular, you can relate the entropy of a black hole to its area by this very precise constant that Hawking discovered. And more precisely, the connection owes its existence to this, which Bekenstein recognized, what's called the second law of black hole physics, which is that the area of the horizon of a black hole always increases. And Bekenstein made a connection between that and the second law of thermodynamics. And Hawking, of course, made it much more explicit by showing that they were proportional and computing the constant. Okay, so that's where things stood in the 70s. But in the last few years, this whole correspondence has been extended not just to static thermodynamic properties, but to dynamical properties, time-dependent properties of precisely the type that you might be interested in the spin system I was just discussing. That's another relation I forgot. So what is this connection? Well, it, again, owes its origins in string theory and work due to the work of many brilliant people. And in this case, what you consider as a black hole, not in flat space, but in what's called a negatively curved space, which is called anti-de Sitter space, in the center of which you put a black hole. And the ADS-CFT correspondence showed that the dynamics of gravity in this space are related to a quantum theory that lives on the edge. And that quantum theory on the edge is very, very similar to precisely the quantum theory I might be interested in at the phase transition between the Nail state and the Willems-Born solid state in flat three dimensions. So in particular, you know, the best understood example is in 3+1 dimension is so-called M2 brain or ADS4 cross S7. And the boundary theory, the super Yang-Mills theory with Yang-Mills gauge fields and at least at high energies and Dirac fermions and scalars carrying the gauge charges. Well, in a very similar, and that theory flows to some strong coupling fixed point, which is conformally invariant. Well, in precisely the same way, the critical point between the NAIL and the VBS states is also described by a gauge theory, according to one proposal, which has relativistic scalars, and in certain superconducting systems even has Dirac fermions. So the precise, and U1 gauge field, the precise particle content is quite different, and it's certainly not supersymmetric. But in many ways, it's very similar. You're described by some non-trivial relativistic field theory that's very at a strongly coupled fixed point. So these conformal field theories now appearing here in at the boundary of ADS4. And the use that has been put to in gravity is, first of all, of course, this temperature of quantum criticality that I mentioned in this yellow region is just the temperature of this black, the Hawking temperature of the black hole. And the entropy is just the entropy of this conformal field theory. And most importantly, for our purposes, now if I look at certain dynamical properties, spin-spin correlation functions on the edge, those are related to properties of waves propagating in this ADS black hole background. And most interestingly, in this finite temperature quantum critical theory, you have various dissipative properties like the spin conductivity or spin diffusivity or the Nernst coefficient that I'm going to discuss very shortly. These are all properties having to do with the approach to thermal equilibrium and the increase of entropy and dissipation. Well, those transport coefficients are related to perfectly conservative equations of Einstein's equations with waves moving this curved phase background, Einstein-Maxwell's equation. And the way the dissipation appears is the one-way property of the horizon where things fall in and don't come out. And that leads to damping, which is eventually related to the damping or the friction properties of the quantum critical theory. Anyway, yes.
I'll
try.
Yeah, no, no, no. So this is from the condensed matter side.
Yeah.
So you have a 2 plus 1 U1 gauge theory coupled to scalar field, say, the simplest.
Yes, yeah.
Tuned to a non-trivial critical point, is that how you get a critical theory out of that?
Yeah, so in that case, there is one relevant parameter, right? You have, but again, the whole point of this phase diagram was to show you that you don't really have to fine-tune if your temperature is finite. So right at zero temperature, yes, you have to sit at a very special point so that a certain relevant operator has zero coupling. But at finite temperature, you can still see these effects over a wider window.
Right, but yeah. Do you know precisely the conformal field theory, the 2 plus 1, but is,
okay,
you don't need it. How well is it understood?
Well, this is precisely the question that Roger and we've been thinking about a lot. So there's a huge debate on this. There's a proposal that we made that it's a certain non-compact U1 gauge theory coupled to two relativistic scalars. I think there's quite a bit of numerical evidence in support of that proposal. What's not clear whether that particular gauge theory really has a conformal fixed point or not. If it doesn't, it may end up being a very weakly perturbed relation in this particular case. But there are many other theoretical examples which are a little bit farther from these experimental, more experimentally connected examples where we establish such theories. In fact, if you take n equals 4 supersymmetric QED, which is studied by Seiberg and Witten and Interligator, they have a phase structure which is extremely similar, and in which case there is a conformal field theory.
Two plus one.
That means that my mind is things are quite different in higher 3 plus 1.
Your conformal field theory lives in two dimensions?
Or in two plus one. Right.
Okay. This is the
and right. Yeah. So just to clarify, following on these questions. So your theory is the 2 plus 1 theory is at any finite temperature that's related to the black hole temperature, or is it down at zero? That wasn't clear to me.
So if I take a real Hamiltonian system like this, which has a lattice, then there's another energy scale here, which is the exchange energy J. Okay, so there's some upper bound here beyond which you can't use any of these techniques, you know, where you really have to go back to the lattice. You know, this lattice is real, it's there, and it's some high scale, you have to worry about the lattice. So there's some upper bound here. But as long as you're below that upper bound and in this yellow region, then you are described. There's just one energy scale that determines the properties here, which is the tensor.
So the 2+1 theory lives in that region.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, everything is 2+1 here. I mean, for us, everything is completely 2+1 dimensional.
But I mean, not just a critical point. That's what I'm
talking. Oh, of course. Yes. And you know, the dual theory is the 3+1 dimension, but it's undoubtedly so strongly coupled that the sense of a 3+1 geometry probably doesn't even make sense. I don't know. You probably know all this. actually, no. I have this. Come on, Mapa has some questions on this related points. And I was very surprised at his point of view about all this geometry. But I think my understanding is that there are some theories, like the ones we're interested in which the 2+1 dimensional representation is much more natural. That's really what they look like. If you were in that world, you would think you were 2+1 dimensional. But the other theories, which formally look 2+1 dimensional, in the large M limit, actually look, are, if you were living in that theory, you would think you were 3+1 dimension and you were a gravity theory. That's, of course, super angles in the large M limit. So these are, you know, two limits. And the extent to which this correspondence is useful to us is where you're talking about properties that can really be common to both limits. Okay. All right, so now let me come back to my home turf. And let's talk about some experiments that we were interested in, which my discussion with string theorists turned out to be very valuable. So let's go back to the Cupid superconductors now and really address the full problem. So here are two examples of Cupid superconductors. And now I'm going to actually not work in the insulator, where you have the anti-ferromagnet, but I'm going to add in charge carriers. And the system goes superconducting above a certain charge carrier density with a critical temperature, which in all the materials has a dip around an 8-fold density. All right, so now before I go to the experiment we're interested in, let me at least describe some remarkable recent scanning tunneling microscopy measurements of the microstructure of the superconductor when you add these mobile carriers. Okay, so here's what you're going to do. You're going to take these crystals and you're going to cleave them just about somewhere, in this case over here in fact, and look at the electrons sitting in the copper optic plane. So if you cleave these crystals, this is what you see. I'm going to go very rapidly over these experimental data. And these are basically the copper atoms right here. You see the square light as a copper atom very beautifully in this image of the surface of these crystals. So this is sub-angstrom resolution.
What were the crosses?
Sorry, these?
The crosses.
These are various impurities and defects.
Yeah. And the different shadings mean what?
okay, this is a topography. Okay, I could spend the whole talk talking about this experiment, but I'm glad to answer this question. So what they're measuring here is the height of the surface by just measuring, you know, the tunneling current in the tip. So the light is probably, you know, a dip in the surface height, and blue is a bump up. So this is just the topography. This is just a contour map of the surface of the crystal. Now you could sit at any given point and measure what's called the differential conductance, that is the rate of change in current with respect to change in voltage. And this is what you see. And this V-shaped structure here is characteristic of a D-wave superconductor that's believed to be present in these materials. And for reasons I won't go into, what they're focusing on in this particular data are this behavior at higher energies. So this is some measure of the local electronic correlations, at each site. So you can measure the spectrum. These different curves are different positions. So you just pick a position on the surface, measure the differential conductance of the voltage, and you get one of these curves. So what they're going to plot first of all, you notice highly asymmetric, and that's telling you something that it really has to do with that the Coulomb repulsion between the electrons playing a huge role. And they're going to measure the asymmetry in these curves by looking at the ratio of the left, the ratio of the integral of the negative bias time current to the positive bias time current. And the reason we're taking the ratio is that a lot of systematic effects just cancel out, depending on how far your tip is above the surface. And you're really measuring something intrinsic on the surface. So when you do that, take the system and take this tunneling asymmetry ratio, you go from here to a plot like this, and this is in another system, another sample here. Okay, there's a lot of information which many, many papers in the literature have analyzed what's going on here. Let me just blow up this configuration and show you my picture of what it looks like. So these are the copper atoms right here. And if you look at the dark versus the bright spots, you can convince yourself that it's made up of these little regions of this type, which have these lines running through. And I'm going to identify these with a tangled pairs of spins. So you do see in this, at least to my jaundiced eyes, rather good evidence for some kind of bond-centered correlations, which we can quite reasonably interpret as these valence bonds forming solids of the way that I discussed at the beginning of this talk. Okay, so that seems to be what's happening at a very short scale in the superconductor, that the electron is trying to entangle and localize in these valence bond solids. In fact, this is a supersolid system is still conducting and probably superheating. So what Skellington microscopy has seen over here is some kind of valence bond correlations. So now I'm going to imagine that as a theorist, I could vary another coupling which I call G. In fact, experimentally you can too, but you by just varying the composition. But these two crystals would have two different values of G. But we can't vary it continuously. We just left to nature's whims of where you might locate a particular system. But again, from these experiments, there's a fair amount of evidence that there is not too far away in parameter space some idealized crystalline state, which is an insulator, at around an atropy. So I'm just going to propose the existence of such a state. And once you propose the existence of such a state, then you can very naturally understand, in particular, this dip in the in TC. That's telling you that it, you know, doesn't go down to zero. It goes to zero only at finite G at this critical point. And this is going to be my proposed conformal field theory, whose influence I'm going to try to detect over here. So that's a lot of suppositions, but at least it's clear what they are. And this gives us the existence of this critical point between a superconductor and an insulator that gives us a handle on a controlled way of talking about this fluctuations in this higher temperature regime. Okay, and the particular experiments that we focused on were these known measurements that I'm now talking about. Okay, for a year of time here. All right, so what is the Nernst effect? Well, the Nernst effect is the following. What we do, you take your superconductor or the normal state above TC, you apply a thermal gradient, you apply a magnetic field in the Z direction, a thermal gradient in this direction, and you measure the voltage in the transfer direction. And the ratio of the thermal gradient to this voltage, or the other way around, the ratio of the voltage to the thermal gradient is the Nernst voltage. And one interpretation of it, which I don't particularly subscribe to, what the interpretation experimenters make. They say that, well, you have some super locally fluctuating superconductor here. When you apply a magnetic field, you create vortices. So there's some gas of vortices in thermal equilibrium. Now, when you apply a thermal gradient, you're going to get thermal conduction of the vortices. The vortices are going to go downhill from hot to cold. So you have a net drift of vortices in this way. And as the vortices are drifting, well, that produces a voltage, because just by taking a vortex of the flux tube, then a moving flux tube gives you a voltage in the transfer direction. And so that's one way of understanding the Nernst effect in the fluctuating superconductor. Well, we say, well, wouldn't it be nice to understand the Nernst effect and get some estimate of its values near the superconductor insulator quantum critical. That was the problem that I've been interested in for many years, and I had no idea how to begin addressing. It really was very complicated. So that's the idea, that you want to take this critical point. Now let me show you the same phase diagram along an axis this way. Then you have a superfluid on one side and an insulator on the other side, maybe even a supersolid somewhere. And in this quantum critical region, we assume extends to the experimental interest. We want to compute the Nernst effect as described by this conformal field theory. That's what we did. Okay. Now, what we really want to do is not just take this ideal of conformal field theory. We want to perturb it in various ways. We're applying a magnetic field, we're applying a thermal gradient. We also are changing the density of characters. The chemical potential is changing. So all of these things are really extremely complicated, and this is really the difficulty in the whole field. We didn't know how to systematically put all these different perturbations together and get a consistent theory of the low energy properties and transport coefficients like the Nernst effect. Now it turns out that this is no problem in the theory of black holes. So what we are doing, we start with a CFT, we apply to it a chemical potential and a magnetic field, and also impurities. We figure out how to do that. Now, by the ADS-CFT connection, if you just take a pure CFT, that's just an ordinary black hole. When you apply a chemical potential, that turns out to be an electric charge on the black hole in the dual theory. When you apply a magnetic field, that turns out to be a magnetic charge. So you end up with a dionic black hole. And so some property of the dionic black hole is related to the Nernst coefficient. That's really where we are. And what we showed, as I mentioned earlier, Marcus and I, with some benefit of hindsight from this, we figured out how to formulate the whole thing from a condensed matter point of view in this so-called hydrodynamic regime. And while Pavel and Sean look at the same thing in the dionic black hole, and we came up with some highly non-trivial sets of relations which I'll quickly flash in front of you, and they were exactly the same in both theories. So what are the kind of results? Okay, this gives you probably too much technicality here. I'll be saved by the bell. So what did we do? We did some fairly standard, but still quite non-trivial relativistic hydrodynamics. I mean, it's not simple, and you're never sure you're doing it right, because there are all kinds of complicated constraints to worry about. But in the end, the most important constraint that comes into the theory is the positivity of entropy production. That's really what leads to all the non-trivial relations. And this has a correspondence, as I mentioned earlier, with the area theorem in general relativity. So Lorentz and positivity of entropy production leads to all kinds of equations that we then solve. Oh, okay, you want to see this? This was several months of work, and we were never sure it was right. Okay. There's no bounds.
There's no bounds.
Oh, you guys don't have to teach. Okay, right. Yeah, but all right, except my own exhaustion. All right.
So you want to see this? Okay, great. I'm happy to go on at length about hydrodynamics. Anyway, so how does it work? Okay, well, the important things are conservation laws. So there's conservation of current, charge, and conservation of energy and momentum. But in a applied magnetic field, there's actually a Lorentz force. So this is modified by this, adding this term was a key thing that we discovered. Then you imagine you're locally in thermal equilibrium, and you deform the system a bit. You give it a local velocity u, and you assume that moving frame, you're in local equilibrium with some energy density E and some pressure P, and some charge density rho. So these are the parameters. You put them in the equations of motion. And finally, you have to also allow for dissipative terms. And in this limit where we're just looking at translation invariant systems with uniform velocities, there's only one term that's allowed. And this complicated combination is what comes out of this. Is responsible for everything, and it comes out from the constraints of entropy production being positive. Another not, you know, use sort of unusual thing we did here was also understand how impurities come in. Impurities come in as a sink for momentum, and we assume that's a weak scattering rate. And so there's a term like that that's allowed the presence of impurities. So you then solve these equations, and you get various results. So for example, you get a relationship. I don't even have them here. I'm sorry. I just deleted the whole thing. So one of the things we can compute, for example, is something called the transverse thermoelectric coefficient, which is closely related to the Nernst effect. And this, the whole field dependence and the temperature dependence here comes in as a consequence of these hydrodynamic constraints. And the whole expression here in detail also obtained from the solution of the dynamic black hole. Right? Everything looks exactly the same. The temperature dependence, the field dependence, the frequency dependence. And in this theory, then, the main parameters that we don't know for comparing the experiments are, one, these numbers. These are universal constants of the conformal field theory, these phis, they're pure numbers. So we just put them equal to 1. So these numbers will be different for different conformal field theories. So for the Super-Yang-Mills theory, in the large n-limit, we know these numbers. They're n to the 3/2, the square root of pi, and so on. For our conformal field theory, we have no idea what they are. But they're of order 1. That's really all we can say. Then there are some dimensionful parameters. The dimensionful parameter, really, one is the impurity scattering rate. And the other is this velocity, the analog of the velocity of light. What is the natural velocity of light here? This is a much slower velocity, having to do with motion of these Cooper pairs near the superconductor insulated condition. So those are really the only free parameters. And the entire temperature and field dependence and density dependence are predicted by this analysis. So, okay, so one of the things that our theory is the first to explain, we believe, is what happens to the thermal truck transverse thermoelectric coefficient as a function of temperature at high temperature, and it falls out as 1 over T to the fourth. And that's exactly what comes out of our analysis. And then by comparing some of the numbers, we can come up with fits to these unknown parameters, the impurity scattering rate and the velocity V. And they both have reasonable values of the order we would estimate, you know, a priori. But of course, we don't know that precisely. But one non-trivial, so can we predict something new? And we can. And what we predict is that there should be, if you were able to do some of these experiments at finite frequency, measure the conductivity in gigahertz frequency range, then you will see a hydrodynamic, what we call a hydrodynamic cyclotron resonance, which has a characteristic field and temperature dependence. And this cyclotron resonance is, in fact, associated to a quasi-normal mode in the dual theory of a black hole. I mean, that's really, it comes in very naturally there. There's one expression for this frequency that Chris Herzog obtained after a lot of analysis in the dual black hole. And it agrees precisely with our expression here, obtained from this kind of hydrodynamic analysis. So it would be great if this could be seen. What's also clear from this fitting that you would really need a very pure sample and have to work in these gigahertz or terahertz frequencies. Well, maybe someday we will. But anyway, we've stuck our neck out as this being the key test of this approach based upon approximate quantum critical point. Yeah.
Yeah, so we are assuming as what's a relativistic critical point for all relativities, you get all the same. So it depends on the dynamic exponent z, assuming z is 1.
Yeah. What exactly are you predicting then? So you're predicting the numbers in front of the...
No, just that this 4, it's been measured experimentally in what comes out of a theory. So that's a post-facto explanation. And then from that, now we can compare this and even fix the numbers. Okay, we don't predict, that's a fit. Then from this fit, then we can predict this. Once you know the numbers, you can now make a quantitative prediction of something else. So this is another plot that I like to show. Mark is still by it, but anyway, there you go. So if you plot the contours of the Nernst effect as a function of field and temperature, you know, this is what our theory roughly predicts. This is what our theory predicts. What am I showing here? Okay. Theory for alpha x, y. This is the experiment. And I think this is our theory for this experiment. Okay. All right. Well, it's got roughly the same shape, and you know, as I said, at low field, it's one over t. No, I mean, you laugh, but for this very complicated experiment, you know, there's really, as far as I know, nothing else that can come even this close. But I agree that at this point, this is a very complicated system, and the fact that you know it's probably not such a good assumption that it's completely dominated by relativistic conformal field theory, often some parameter space. It's at least giving you qualitatively some of the right physics. That's really all I expected, in fact. And it's more than I expected from this simple theory. anyway. So, since I'm over time, let me now move on to the next part, which is very briefly some more recent work where we think we feel we're much more confident and much sounder footing, and hopefully just a matter of doing the right experiment, but we think you really should see a lot of these effects. And that's quantum criticality in graphene. So since you had a colloquium on graphene last week, it's a two-dimensional layer of carbon atoms where we focus only on the pi orbitals, one electron again per carbon, now on the hexagonal lattice. And if you just take three electrons in the hexagonal lattice, you find that the low energy excitation consists of two species, well, two Dirac fermions, one at this point of Redoin zone, and then the other at the other point. And so near both of these points, you have this conical dispersion relation for the energy of the Dirac for these electrons. The spin here is not physical spin. In fact, all of these, the electronic spin, the usual spin, is the same everywhere on the Dirac, just a flavor label. The Dirac spin is really a sublattice label of the green and red sides on the graphene lattice. Anyway, so now these are not free Dirac fermions. They interact with each other with a Coulomb interaction. So you can take a Dirac theory and add in a Coulomb interaction. And very easily you'll see that, in fact, this interaction is dimensionless in the field theory sense. That is, you can now take the combination of the charge of the electron and the fermion velocity and create a fine structure constant. So this fine structure constant is not 1 over 137, but it's about 1 because this velocity is so much smaller than the velocity of light. So this is a theory. It's a relativistic theory with a dimensionless parameter. That's starting to look almost like a conformal field theory. But it's not exactly conformal. It's got an RG flow. So unlike super Yang-Mills theory, where you have a free parameter in super Yang-Mills theory, it doesn't flow, it's a zero beta function. Here, the beta function is not zero. But that's a relatively soft breaking of relativistic invariance, and we can account for that in almost any calculation. So you get at low energies, this coupling goes to zero. So it's infrared free. But at higher temperatures, intermediate temperature is lambda is about a 1. And roughly speaking, lambda is 1 over the log of the temperature scale or any other scale. And so if you ignore the flow, assume lambda is roughly constant over some measurable temperature range, then it's really very closely related to properties here. So now we can take everything we have learned about various response functions of CFTs and apply it here. With a few changes that we, you know, I won't go into, but we figure out quite easily. So we can now make predictions here, particularly this cyclotron resonance, hydrodynamic cyclotron resonance, should also be present here. We can say exactly where it's at, and you know, it's just we are hoping that this in the near future, this could be seen in the experiments. We can also predict the value of the inertia effect, the temperature dependence, for which there was no previous theory.
And there are people trying to look at the inertia effect in graphene these days. So we'll see how well this works. OK, so that's the end of my talk. a good friend of mine, Jan Zanen, is at least one person who liked this work because he wrote this article in Nature. Which, what I like best about it is the title, a very clever title, about how by studying black holes, you're getting answers to very different questions, or at least theories of very different problems, somehow being related. That's at least theoretically interesting. I think whether we've explained some properties of high-temperature superconductors is probably saying a bit too much. Oh, he doesn't say that, and neither have we. Okay, all right, so that's the, so what I've talked about, I began with just a quick review of quantum phase transition in antiferromagnets, how they lead to interesting critical points described by conformal field theory, and then some measurable properties of these conformal field theories are related to, by duality, to properties of black holes. And this insight, this connection, has certainly taught me a lot of things and enabled us to do a whole range of calculations we had no idea to do before, how to do before. And I want to just end by this transparency, which is stolen from Gary Horowitz. In the end, in one representation, all we're doing is just solving Einstein's equations, or the Einstein-Maxwell's equation, in the presence of various black holes. And what we've learned over the last decade is that these solutions of Einstein's equation, after suitable interpretation, have all kinds of physics buried in them we never imagined. I mean, we certainly knew they describe black holes in gravitational waves, but they also describe, you know, the normalization group flow from low to high energy as a function of the radial scale. They have hydrodynamic properties and properties, you know, not just the entropy, but dynamical properties and transport coefficients and a theory of quantum criticality. And very recently, a beautiful paper by Hartnell, Herzog, and Horowitz shown that you can even extend this not just in the quantum critical region. Here, go back to my phase diagram. Yeah, so here, oops. Well, there's many. Oh. No. I can't draw. It's all here. Yeah, here we go. So I've really only talked about this region here, which is just, so the characteristic property of this region, you take a conformal field theory, in other words, you take a black hole, and you go to finite temperature. And of course, the Hawking temperature of the black hole is the temperature of the conformal field theory. And then you had some small perturbations. You could add an electric charge, which corresponds to changing the density. You can add a magnetic charge that corresponds to putting a magnetic field. You put in some impurities that correspond to putting a sink for momentum, whose correlators you can compute from the black hole theory. But those are all small perturbations. You're basically near this region. More recently, what Horowitz, Hartnell, and Herzog have discussed is what happens if you have a really large perturbation where you actually cross this boundary into the superfluid. Then you're really going out of the, you know, this whole region is not described by this fixed point. This region is described by a fixed point out here, which is like the Higgs phase. It's not the conformal phase, but it's like a confining phase, that the other side is like a confining phase. So they've managed to extend at least at the level of classical gravity, a picture into the superconducting state. And has a lot of interesting properties, and I'm sure it's a matter of time before Sean and others figure out the Nernst effect here too. That's a very direct consequence of what they've been doing. So that's an exciting direction in more recent times, extending it to a wider regime now. In these very artificial models from our perspective, but we're still learning a lot from them. Okay, thank you.
We're talking about this correspondence and that you calculate the correlation function in both of the theories and you get a similar result. But is the calculation easier in one of the branches than in the other one?
It depends on your background. Well, first of all, I should say that you raise a good point that I didn't make clear. In the dual gravity theory. It's a complete cut. You know, you in principle, you just turn the crank and you compute everything. And it's you know, you have a set of equations, you solve them, you get everything. In the kinetic system, on the other side, we can't compute everything. It's a strongly coupled system. We can only write down certain general constraints. But there are a whole bunch of parameters that we don't know, like the transport coefficient, the equation of state, these various universal regions. We don't know. So there's there are a whole bunch of constraints that we can apply. So that's really all we did, apply all those constraints. And that still is very powerful. And we found that this other calculation, which I knew nothing, you know, it's a completely different language, knew nothing about any of these constraints or even entropy or anything, obeyed everything precisely. But we can only compute a much more limited set for the problems of interest for the experiments. Yeah.
So inside the gravity, this is a non-rotating black hole that's anti-de Sitter.
It's anti-de Sitter asymptotic.
Asymptotic, yes, but non-rotating.
I believe that's right. It's got a magnetic charge and it's a curved black hole.
Well, that means it's rotating.
No. What is it then?
Reisner-Nordström. Right. My question was, what would rotation do?
What would rotation do?
Do you have any feeling about that?
Okay, maybe something.
If you add another parameter to the black hole, you presumably must change something in from the condensed matter viewpoint, but I don't have any feeling for what it would be.
So you're just putting a net angular momentum to the
black hole. Yeah, that's right. It'd be some kind of thermodynamic potential, I presume, but I don't really.
I mean, it could be if you're also rotating the conformal field theory. I don't know.
I was told by Sean Hartnell that it does nothing.
Does nothing? Okay. All right.
I'm just kidding.
Thank you for saying that. You know, when I get questions like this, I usually call Sean. So. I'm surprised.
How are the impurity described in the black?
Yeah. So right. That I slept over that one. So in the hydrodynamic approach, we just put it as a sink from momentum. But now the question is, so you can't really put it in the black hole theory. But what you can do is say I want to just perturbatively determine the value of the impurity scattering rate. Well, you can relate this impurity scattering rate to essentially the correlator of the time derivative of the momentum. So you need the momentum-momentum correlation function. That you can compute in the black hole theory. So you can, in the black hole theory, you can look at the leading perturbative effect of impurity. And you can match that to the leading perturbative effect in hydrodynamics. And then you get the value of the coefficient. But if you want the full effect at low frequencies, then you have to use the hydrodynamics. I can't do that in the black hole. You just match the short time behavior, and you extrapolate to long times by using the hydrodynamic equations. So this was a technique we just fair enough.
Have you the license here in the place? Do you have the license here for the original system on the other?
The Lagrange. Well, I certainly have the Lagrange for our conformal field theory in 2+1 dimensions. I do not have the Lagrange for the dual gravity theory of that, if even such one exists. Although Lee claims to have some in their formulation. I mean, of related theories, I think. For the supersymmetric case, yes, I mean, that's known. And on one side, you have super Yang-Mills with N equals 8 supersymmetric, so that's a unique theory you get by compactifying N equals 1 supersymmetric Yang-Mills from 10 dimensions down to 3. And the dual theory is 11 dimensional supergravity. But you only look at the bosonic part, so in the end, you're just looking at the Einstein-Michaels equations in AES4.
But for example, superconductivity, for the case of superconductivity, there is no kind of speciality of the Lagrangian associated to the system. Is that generic?
No. I misunderstood your question. What gives you superconductivity? Well, this is another totally different question which I have not addressed at all. We believe it's related to these anti-Poiseuille, you know, it's intimately connected through this signal, very crudely speaking. Go back to the beginning of my talk. Oh, there's a way of doing this. Ah, there we go. Okay.
Oh. Can you type in a number?
Yeah, you're right, can't I? This is my daughter's computer, because my computer crashed last night. So it's slower. Now she wants a new one, and I have no choice to get her a better one. Where was I? So, right. So, if I just take this at the crudest level, let me just go to this model right here. Okay, I went too far, sorry. This is interesting. here. So, in this model, of course, what happens to the insulator is the spins form this antiferromagnetic state, which optimizes this energy. But when you, in the real system, you actually dope with carriers. In this particular model, you don't dope with carriers, you add some other perturbation, which destroys this order.
And what the spins want to do then is form valence bonds. So you can think of these valence bonds as some kind of precursors to the Cooper pairs. So there is, that's where the pairing is coming from. That's kind of the Anderson-RVG picture, although modified quite a great deal here. But that's the basic idea, that the tendency of the antiferromagnetic exchange interaction promotes the formation of singlet valence bonds, just like in a hydrogen molecule or in benzene. And these singlet valence bonds, when they're able to move and carry charge, they're superconducting. So that's, in a nutshell, the theory of ITC. I think most people agree with that picture, but there's a lot, you know, the devil's on the details. We're all arguing about, well, okay, that's a nice picture, but can you actually compute something with it? What are some of the details?
Other questions? Is there a quantum computer to be made?
Well, you know, I just said, right, you know, the quantum computer, you're tuning 10,000 different couplings and moving qubits around. Yeah. I'd be happy to tune one coupling, and you hear all kinds of interesting faces. That's really all I care about. I mean, so I think it's the first step. Quantum computers are much farther away.
Okay, very good. You're here the rest of today and tomorrow for the symposium, which I think is on the webpage. And thank you very much.